I think it's about 11 o'clock, so we'd love to begin. Thank you for coming. This is a session on creating a sustainable planet. I'm John Marty. This is my last of the presentations this week. It's been a great week in the village. I'll introduce myself for those who don't know. I've been serving in the Minnesota State Legislature and the Minnesota Senate for actually half my life now, 30 years, and I chaired, as of 2 years ago, I was chairing the Energy and Environment Committee. I've served as chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee a number of years earlier. Spend a lot of time on this whole issue and think it's very important we talk about long term, because somebody once said in politics, long term thinking is the next election. And we should be thinking in the Native American terminology of the seventh generation out. So wanted to make this discussion, start this discussion. I'm going to start with some PowerPoints. I'm not going to go all the way through with PowerPoints. And some of these are things that we might see as kind of depressing or frightening in some ways. And so wanted to start with that and then move for where we are and how we move forward from that with discussion. So anyway, we have an unsustainable economy. I'd make the point that every part of the economy, our energy consumption, our transportation system, our land use, our agriculture system, it is all unsustainable. Population growth is driving some of that, a lot of that, but it's certainly not the only factor. And we are quickly running out of resources. 30 years ago, Paul Simon, a U.S. senator who had actually been to Holden Village one time, he actually said he could envision the day when we were not fighting wars over oil, but wars over water. And I think already there are many conflicts. Palestine is one of them, where water rights and water use is a huge fight. We certainly see that in the Western states in the U.S. Anyway, to put things in perspective on timelines of the planet, the Earth is 4.6 billion years old. Let's suggest it was 46 years, so 1 year per billion years. We've been here for 4 hours, the human race. Our Industrial Revolution began a minute ago, and in that time we've destroyed more than half of the world's forests. And I think that that's what we have to see, because we see our view of things is our lifetime. I'm 60, and I can see changes that have occurred in the world in 60 years, and I've read about history. We all have done that. But nevertheless, our perspective is how long we've been here, and to see that the human Industrial Revolution would have been 1 minute ago if the Earth was 1 year old. If the Earth was 46 years old, excuse me. So sustainability of forest. This is a picture of cows grazing at the edge of a rainforest that was being burned down to create more grassland for grazing. We talk about deforestation in the rainforest, which is a huge environmental crisis. Minnesota, we're talking, there's a potato firm that grows potatoes for McDonald's trying to clear-cut forests in west central Minnesota to convert more land to potato growth. Paris climate talks called for an end to all deforestation for any purposes because of what we're doing. Again, if we've lost half of the rainforest in the last, that 1 minute of time in the Earth's history, that 1 minute out of 46 years, we've lost half the rainforest. You can see we've got half the forest, we've got a crisis coming. Climate change is obviously one of the most urgent issues, urgent because of the catastrophic size of it. This is a picture of, it's hard to see, but it might be a nice piece of artwork, but these are gunk pits and so on. This is land in Alberta where tar sands mining is occurring. It's some of the dirtiest oil we have, but it was being done because it's saleable and so on. This is pumping out sludge from the mining there. This is perhaps the worst of our fossil fuels for burning, but it's happening, and there's a big push to get a new pipeline through Minnesota to carry a replacement pipeline, which would be more than twice as big, to carry a lot more of this stuff into the country for processing and then largely for export, in effect. I'm not going to go into a lot of science here, but just on the climate change, this chart is in hundreds of thousands of years ago, 800,000 years ago, close to a million years ago, 700, 600. This is the CO2, the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. As you can see, it's been between 200, 250, ups and downs. There's cycles go up and down. And then you can see at the very far right, it goes way up. Here's a chart that shows it more for the most recent decades, from 1960 to 2010. And you can see this is, in the previous chart, 320 is up there. So 50 years ago, it was higher than these other times. And now it's just off the charts up there. Over 400 parts per million now. The group 350.org that Bill McKibben formed was meant because they felt 350 was the tipping point. The Earth could sustain without getting warmer if we bring it down below 350 parts per million. But we are producing CO2 gases, emissions, as high as we ever have now. Despite all the efforts to do it, we are still not, have not turned the corner on that. Population is one of the causes of this. I just think that, again, when we're looking at the big picture perspective, not the our lifetime or our kids' lifetime, but from the dawn of humanity, it took till 1804 to create the first billion people in population. Disease and other things obviously made that much harder. Then it took 123 years to get to double that population. 33 years, that was shortly, not too long after I was born, to get 3 billion people. By the time I graduated from high school, it was 4 billion. First time I came to Holden, the year after I was elected, it was 5 billion. 6 billion, now we're well over 7 billion people. And even if we had a zero population growth, each two people produce two offspring that live to produce two offspring. Even if we have a flat, stable population that way, because of the age mix, by the time it takes 60, 70 years for that to flatten out, by which time we will have perhaps 9 billion people if we do a better job than we're doing now of addressing population growth. But this is an issue we don't have a lot of politicians talking about. It's a sensitive issue in Congress. Family planning funds for other countries get tied up in abortion politics, and funding for addressing family planning has been cut. Our political system, as I mentioned, is not addressing long-term things. It addresses a crisis, and crisis, well, we adapt to things. We find our way to address more population, but it is causing a lot of the resource consumption and everything else. This is a picture of, I can't remember what city this is, but when you think of, this is a lot of office towers, a lot of residential stuff, these huge cities of multi-millions of people, each one of those lights in residential buildings is going to be somebody's home, sometimes multiple people in a family. You look at what we're doing just to absorb the housing needs of everybody, let alone the food needs and everybody, the energy needs. We are using the planet up in a rate that is not sustainable. So we talk about our consumption of resources and our generation of waste. And when we talk about consumption of resources, in politics, every political party, and it's not just in the U.S., but most countries, when we talk about building the economy, creating jobs, it's always how we're going to produce more, we're going to produce faster. How many flat-screen TVs do we need? How many whatever? I don't know. Some of you may have seen the pictures of cell phone piles of how many of are disposed in the planet per day. Massive, massive numbers and resources that we can't, I mean, billions are numbers we can't comprehend. To put things in mind, you can count to a million if you're counting one number per second. A million seconds is about 3-some days. A billion seconds is about 33 years. And all of a sudden you get the sense, if you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, to a billion, it's 33 years of counting. So we generate a whole lot of stuff. This is a picture of container port, container packaging for shipping things overseas and so on. just the sheer scope of these things is hard to imagine. And the waste. This is piles of waste in, I think this is in Bangladesh, piles of waste, piles of garbage, much of which we burn, the rest we landfill. We don't think about it, it's waste. Hoogland may be one of the few places where we talk about our waste in a logical way. And I thought this was a great sign I saw down in Garbo, down below the dining hall. It says, "We cannot throw anything away," in quotes, "for there is no away. The earth is a closed system, therefore let us live simply and gently as best we can." I thought there's a lot of great philosophy down if you read the signs around Hoogland Village. But we can't throw things away, and we don't address it in a logical way. As I mentioned, politicians' solution is always to generate more. That's how we get the economy flowing. After 9/11, George W. Bush was trying to, in a very good way, I think, trying to say we want to create calm and normalcy, and because people didn't know what was happening, who's doing what and what's next, what other skyscrapers are going to fall, what other planes are going to fall. We didn't know, and his message was, what can you do to help the future? Go shopping. That was what he said. I don't know if you remember that. It was, and it was actually probably a logical thing to say at the time because you wanted people to go back to not panic and everything else. But the consumption patterns we all have is how many people like to go shopping. For what? I don't know. We got enough clothes. We got enough everything. But we like to shop. And that kind of pattern is something that is clearly unsustainable. And well, what do you do about the jobs? And I'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But it is a problem because we could be channeling. We have to look at a future. You have to say, well, if fewer people are needed to produce more and more crops, fewer people are needed to produce more and more technology, fewer and fewer people to fill mines, operate mines. Northern Minnesota, our taconite mines, our iron ore production mines, they actually are producing a pretty decent amount this year. It depends on the year, how much glut there is in the world market and iron and steel prices. But you need one miner to do what there were probably 1,000 were needed for a century ago. So we're producing more faster and fewer people. And the solution is always, well, then we got to consume more. But again, throwing things away when there is no away. To start to change the discussion to how we move to a sustainable economy, I wanted to quote Robert Kennedy, who was running for president in 1968. This is a lengthy quote, but it's a beautiful quote. He says, "We seem to have surrendered community excellence and community values, our values, in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product, if we should judge America by that, counts the locks on our doors and the jails for those who break them, counts the destruction of our redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder and chaotic sprawl. In fact, our gross domestic product, which is a way we measure the economy, it's the main way we measure the economy. If I get an auto accident, I'm boosting the economy because it's going to have health care dollars, it's going to have auto repair dollars, it's going to have maybe new auto sales dollars. It's a measure the economy is doing better. So good things and bad that expand the economy does." But he's trying to, Robert Kennedy is here expressing what we should be thinking about. Gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. Does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither the wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it tells us everything about America except why we are proud that we are Americans. And I want to use that to start jumping off to talking about how we can change the way we do things, about how we can move forward. Not the political answer, oh, all we have to do is this and just go make this happen, but how we have to re-envision our thinking. We can't just keep, when politicians say, and both parties do, I know I and everybody talk about economic growth, and the way we usually mean that is produce more. And we're concerned about the loss of manufacturing jobs to overseas. We need manufacturing jobs. I mean, service jobs don't do anything. But in a sense, we have to. If you have in the last century, if one farmer back then could feed a dozen or 20 families, and in the last 100 years, it's one farmer may be able to produce enough food for hundreds of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands and thousands of people, certainly. The growth in it has been maybe a 90-100-fold efficiency gains. Computer technology, the one most of all. I mean, you look at computer technology, the technology you have in your pocket is far more sophisticated than the computers that sent people to the moon and back. They say that computer data availability, storage, and costs and everything else goes down by a factor of 10 every, I'm not sure how often, but it's very quickly, a couple of years, and we keep multiplying and multiplying and multiplying. And so as we get new technologies change at different rates, but because of the way we think about things, well, government's not getting more efficient. Schools aren't getting more efficient. You know, if schools were to make the kind of efficiency improvements that that we made in agriculture, each teacher should be teaching a couple thousand students. Gets really good when you're talking to other things. String quartet. How are they going to improve their efficiency? Well, get rid of one of the members? Well, it's not quite the same thing. It's a string trio. They could play a lot faster. No, that's not the point of it. And the point is, a lot of the things that matter in life that Kennedy is at least referring to, caring for child care. Child care providers are not getting a lot more efficient. We still have, and matter of fact, we prohibit them from doing too many children in a child care setting. One care provider can provide for two or three, depending on the state, newborns. They can handle a couple more this level. When they get to toddlers, they can have a few more. But we don't want to have our kids do that. We don't want people who need a personal care attendant to have, well, I can be a personal care attendant for 10 people and we'll automate everything we can, automate feeding them somehow, automate whatever. It doesn't work that way. And when we assume in the economy, well, you're not doing your job because you're not gaining productivity enough, we have to understand these differences and make a point about how we're doing different. But when you think about the way we look at the economy and jobs, one of the biggest issues, I mean, there are so many people who can't find work. It's hard to say it right now because the economy is doing relatively well and unemployment is relatively low. But there are many times that the issue is, how do we create jobs? And it's not like there's a shortage of things to do. I mean, cleaning up messes, you know, litter pickup. In India, they actually have people sweep the streets. I hate to think of how little they are paid, how many pennies they are paid per day, but it's the only work they can get. But nevertheless, picking up messes. Kids who need more mentors, more tutors, more help. Schools. Minnesota's laid off teachers a number of times in recent years for budget reasons. There are so many things that need to be done in a society that aren't being done. And there's so many people looking for work. And, well, we need to create more production. We got to consume and produce more. One of the ways we ought to be looking at things is, what's the impact on our actions on the seventh generation forward? What we do when we consume things. If I use Holgan's system here, I don't know whose water bottle is, vitamin water is zero. This was in the hike house, is a water bottle, and when I'm done, I put it in the dish pit, and it gets sterilized and gets put out there again. But when you think about this, this is a 20-ounce, fluid ounce bottle of nutrient-enhanced water beverage. I don't know how much it sells for. I guess at a grocery store, far less than a dollar, but a convenience store, maybe a buck and a half, 20-ounce bigger size. Somebody bought that. They consumed it, and here they brought it here so it could be reused. But 99.99% of these bottles are consumed one time, and most of them are not even recycled. They are thrown in a landfill where it will thrive for or exist for millennia. And you keep thinking, how much did it cost to produce the water beverage in here? How much did it cost to produce the bottle and the label and the marketing and transporting it? most of the value of it, the value that's useful to us, went down our throats in a few minutes, but this remains. And so Holden, where again they're trying to reuse things and sanitizing them to make sure that works, we think about our convenience, and yet our grandchildren are going to have mountains of landfills and stuff where we produce all this stuff and no way to get rid of it. And we don't think about that. So in addition to addressing, well, how many people can one planet survive, hold, we have to think about how we use the resources and how we change that. And in the past, we've had, when there's a problem, often new technology will solve it. If we had no new, if we didn't get the creation of the automobile and fossil fuel-driven even transit systems, New York City and other places would be buried in manure. I mean, you couldn't have a city of 5 million people if it was horse-driven transportation system, horse and buggy thing. You just couldn't deal with all the manure or the room for stabling of the horses. Well, new technologies took over that, and we've had many times that happens. In terms of energy use, the lights in here, I don't know if these are LED yet. They look like these are compact fluorescent. That cut the energy consumption 6 or 7-fold, depending on what you're using. So there are technologies that make advances and new ways of dealing with things that we couldn't have imagined. But we don't put our efforts into changing our behavior that way. I would argue when we look at the destruction done by new mining, first thing we ought to be mining is our trash stream, and not make it a trash stream, but make it something we try and address there. And I'm going to open it up for discussion in just a minute, but I want to suggest that that new technology stuff is huge, and we couldn't survive without that. I carried a bill that became law, which has since been repealed just 4 years later, that was requiring Minnesota to develop a strategy, a planning framework on how we could move to 100% fossil fuel-free economy. I didn't have a timeline in it because I don't know how you can do it. But the goal was to be the first state to do that, arguing actually, one, be helping the environment, two, we'd be creating more jobs, and three, I actually think the first states, the first countries to do it are the ones that are going to benefit the most economically. Their technology, their knowledge base will be exported to others rather than them importing what other people designed and invented and so on. But that was designed to pull together environmental community, utilities, everybody, business community, workers, farmers, everybody, pull them together and say, how can we move forward in a logical way? Minnesota has since repealed that because a lot of people don't think climate is a concern at all, and they don't care if it's good jobs or not. They say it isn't. Hawaii has since gone ahead and said they're going to do it. Hawaii has a lot different economics because all their fuel has to be imported except for renewables, except for wind and solar, and if they have geothermal or whatever they're going to use. The oil, diesel, other fuels they bring in to heat their buildings, to put on their power plants, is far more expensive electricity there, so it happens faster there. But trying to change those economics, trying to change it so we see in a different way, so we plan in a different way, is a very difficult thing to do. And again, getting back to this, because of the fact when I said if the Earth was 46 years old instead of 46 billion, then the Industrial Revolution 1 minute ago it started. When we say the native concept of seventh generation, I don't know how many of us, I could name my grandparents 2 generations back, could name some of my great-grandparents, but not all of them. And that's 3 generations back, and a lot of people now, because longer life expectancy, know not just their children, but their grandchildren, that means not just their grandchildren, but their great-grandchildren, 3 generations, and some even great-great-grandchildren. But none of us are going to know 5 generations, 6 generations, 7 generations down. But if we care as deeply about our kids and their future as we care about ourselves, then we want them to be happy. And if they are going to care as much about their kids as we do, they can't be happy unless their kids have a future. And if you think about it that way, if we get rid of our mindset that I own what I own and this is my land, this is my right to do what I want with it, my resources, No, we are. If we see ourselves as stewards for the future, then we have to do it. So I want to open it up now, and I start by stressing the idea. We often talk about, well, if plan A doesn't work, what's plan B? Well, I think many of you have seen this. There is no planet B. Last few months, there have been discussions. There have been some thoughts that they think they found some planets on a sun about the right distance away from a sun, about the same temperature range that we're in, that they think they could conceivably hold a life, a human life, perhaps, whatever. They are 30 light years away. If we could travel at the speed of light, which we couldn't, I mean, if we sent a rocket there, it wouldn't get there before 20 generations from now. So we can't move all of us to another planet. There is no planet B. And we've got a beautiful place, and we better preserve it. So with that, I wanted to open it up for discussion, and maybe you can hit the lights over there. But I want to open it up for discussion about how we move forward in terms of changing the discussion. You know, I'm going to make a pitch for a book. I think I saw it in the bookstore still. It's called Affluenza. It's about a 15-year-old book, and it was talking about how we have a new disease in our society that could be called affluenza. And they said consumption several generations ago was a disease. And it was, TB? No, what was it?
Yes.
TB? It was consumption was a disease, and now we consume as if there's no future. How do we change our mindset where more is not better, and the bumper sticker, he who dies with the most toys wins? I mean, it's so anti what our faith teaches about, what our humanity teaches us, but it's what our economy is pushing. How do we move forward? How do we change both our mindset in our home communities, our churches, and so on? How do we deal with the political system and convince people we have to look in a different way? Yes?
I know one of the cool places in my hometown, I'm from Austin, Texas, there's a zero waste grocery store, and I haven't been able to go yet because I spend very little time at home since I'm in college. But the difference between the college town that I go to Texas A&M University in College Station. There's about 90,000 people in College Station, 160,000 in the Bryan College Station area. Compared to Austin, which is a growing metroplex city, is crazy, because if there were to be a zero-waste store started up in College Station, I bet people would just drive past it and laugh at it. It's a land of big trucks. It's a place with, wannabe cowboys, people
right.
that thrive off of, I have more stuff than you, my stuff is bigger than yours, because everything's bigger in Texas. But it's a cool thing to see that, like you were saying with this water bottle, instead of, you know, buying a milk carton every single week, you can just go and fill it up. Or buying, I know I eat Honey Nut Cheerios for breakfast, or some type of cereal. Instead of having to buy a box that not only has cardboard, but then plastic, going and just refilling up, things like that. And it can be as easy as that, because that's still economics. Like, it's still putting things into the economy. You're exchanging money, someone is working, but it's not necessarily taking away anything. It's just helping with the sustainability. Cutting out a lot of the middle pieces that are very detrimental to the environment.
Yeah, we want to follow up on your thing with two things. One is, it's good to see that happening, that change happening, but it's also very real what you said about, your college town, which is part of the American thing. We can consume more. The more I have, the more I can flaunt what I've got. I got a bigger, more powerful pickup than you do. And you look at these, pickups are not meant to be recycled. Getting the auto industry to make things, and what we're going to have to do is, as we manufacture products, make them dismantleable as well, so we can take the resources out better. Right now, a lot of products are meant to burn out at a certain time. Apple, you can't replace the batteries in them. And they're not meant to be taken apart either. So trying to figure out that way, how do we deal with the population that sees a different way? How do we wake them up to this until we come to the point where climate gets so bad, resources get so bad, And again, with the lack of resources, we don't think about it till it's too late. I talked earlier about drinking water. I'll raise one or two that maybe nobody's ever thought of or heard of. Helium. Helium is not something, the only way we can produce it is by nuclear fusion, which we don't really have a good system of doing. But there's a lot of naturally occurring helium on the planet, and once it's up in the atmosphere, there's no way to get it back. And yet we use it for children's balloons, for all kinds of good, fun things. But it's a resource we need for research. We need it for a lot of medical stuff because it doesn't interact with anything. Very inert gas. So we don't preserve that. We don't have, the U.S. has a strategic reserve of helium, but it's very small. And as soon as helium, well, I don't know when it'll happen, but helium prices, I could picture 20, 30 years from now being 100-fold what they are now, and all of a sudden people say, well, we're not using helium for balloons or for fun things, we're using it for things we need it for. Sand outside of water and a few other resources, sand is one of the most frequently used things for everything from construction to everything. California is now having shortages of sand. It's not that you can't get sand, but hauling sand is extremely expensive. And we go through every kind of resource as fast as we can. How do we deal with the people she mentioned at College Station, Texas, where I think every one of us knows maybe a majority of people in our communities feel that way? Any thoughts on that?
I think education has to be primary, right? If you change, or if you include some sort of curriculum in early education, for the kids, by the time they get to college or the time they get to, I need a big truck, they're probably a little bit more conscious about the earth.
If the kids are talking about it and learning about it in school, then they come home and put pressure on their parents.
Kids do put pressure on parents and do that. That's, none of that's going to change the fact that, if every one of us in here and all of our friends start going to, as you said, zero waste grocery stores, if we don't have any carbon impact on the planet, which is, you couldn't do if you wanted to right now in modern society, it'd be virtually impossible to right now. We know there are ways to get there and we know we have to, but if everybody here does that and everybody else says, well, I'm gonna keep driving bigger and bigger trucks and I'm gonna keep consuming more and more, that doesn't do it. So we do have to do the education. We have to do the, as you said, kids teaching others. That's a huge role, I'd argue, for the faith community and the churches and so on. You had to follow up and then I'll get back there again.
Yeah, but along with consumerism or with education, it can't just happen with kids because a lot of the times there's a drastic difference between like kids and adults and the way that they spend money. Because I know when I was growing up, my parents are divorced, so they have a lot less money coming in because it's not one unit, it's two separate ones. And my mom was always great at teaching us that there's a difference between a want and a need. So do you want new shoes or do you need new shoes? Like, now my shoes are coming apart, there's no traction on them, I need new shoes. But do I just want to buy another pair of Converse because they'll match that one shirt I own? There's a difference. And I see a lot of kids... And I myself am guilty of this, is that it's just, oh, I can spend my money. Oh, I can buy more, because why not? And so even if it's, yes, there needs to be education in schools, I don't disagree with that. But I think that there also needs to be education with the way that people treat money and how they teach their kids about money, because it might not, they might give their kid a choice. All right, you're going to get a car when you're 16 years old. What car do you want? And they're going to be like, wow, I'm 16. The cool thing is a Jeep or a truck or an SUV to take all my friends around. And so that education needs to not only be brought into the school systems like you're talking about, but it needs to be elsewhere. Even outside of just churches or whatnot, because there's a vast majority of people who don't ever frequent stuff like that.
Well, I would argue everything we're talking about, you're going to have to do this, and you're going to have to do this, and we have to change public policies as well, which is my thing I'm trying to work in, but you can't do that without getting an understanding why you're talking about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think when I talk about something like seventh generation and concern for that, with my colleagues, it's kind of, what planet are you from? I mean, it's not part of our political rhetoric of either party. I mean, it's just kind of, that's so far out of the realm. We do know we have to produce more, we have to consume more. The way you drive the economy is spend more. But yeah.
In some respects, I think that, I mean, yeah, and basically in the way that you drive the economy by spending more, and the way that you, it all comes down, so for me as an individual, if I just try to save as much money as I can, then my environmental impact will be minimized, right? Period. Like, if I'm spending in one scenario, I'm spending twice as much money in my life as the other scenario, then that's going to be more consumption, right? And so in many ways, it largely comes down to consumption costs money. And so often this is like the main thing, I think, that hits people in these decision-making. I've got family in Texas too, so not to rail on Texas too hard, but they're right outside of Austin, and I went back there a couple of years ago, and my uncle needed some gas in his massive pickup truck, but the cheapest gas was like 35 miles away, so we like loaded up in the truck to drive 35 miles to get the cheap gas for his truck, right? And so there's these
the mindset that people don't think about, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's these right. So he's like cost conscious, but then there's the there's this like these other factors, this disconnect. Whereas like living in a city and paying like for an Uber or something every single time I want to go somewhere, like brings those costs down to a more local level. So I mean, I can imagine my vehicle, like every mile I drive, ticking to tell me how much it's costing for me to do that based on my insurance rate and my like rate of the gas rates in my town or something like this, to kind of bring those costs home so that they're not just something
measurable costs. Well, there's actually a group of folks that were many years ago holding folks in the Twin Cities, St. Martin's community, where they actually decided they were going to voluntarily put a climate gas tax on their own cars. Every mile they drove, they were going to put in, or every gallon they used, they were going to put in a dollar into this fund for sustainability, trying to show it. But it isn't, it's very hugely an educational thing and got a long way to go in that. Over here.
What I find difficult, I guess, I agree with all of the importance of conserving and sustainability and all that. I think it's exactly what needs to happen. However, our economy is based on a consumer economy. And I think, I don't know what the numbers are. You may know that better than me, but our economy is dependent on consumerism to a huge degree. And if we stop consuming, then we stop having enough jobs, we stop having a kind of a world or country in which there are not enough jobs and so on and so forth. Can you talk
sure.
more about that?
Sure, and that's where, I mean, by the way, none of this, when I don't let me get off the track of this for more than a minute, but that plan for making Minnesota 100% fossil fuel free, I had some advocates say, well, I could see how you could get to 80%. That's easy. Well, easy for them. I mean, because they could see with this technology, you do this and this much with wind and this much with solar and this much with energy efficiency. But I don't see how you get the last 20%. I said, I don't either. 20 years ago, the idea that you could get 30% or so of your energy supplies from renewable energy was, we didn't have the technology there. The idea of electric cars, I mean, that was tried 100 some years ago, but no way you could go more than very short distance then. Now, when Tesla and others started with these very expensive cars, the technology is constantly changing and doing that. So you don't always know what the next step is. You have to plan ahead, knowing that you do the things you know for sure work now and the maybes, and 5 years from now, what the low-hanging fruit, in effect, the certainties change over 5 years. You keep moving forward and planning for the future. Same thing in terms of that energy consumption and how new technologies work, new knowledge. Same thing in terms of how the economy changes. You could not overnight, just as you couldn't say, well, let's be fossil fuel free or let's stop you burning fossil fuel. Okay, then how are we going to get out of Holden Village? You are stuck here. The buses use it, the boat uses it, the car and everything you use to get beyond it. You couldn't just do it or we'd freeze in place. You could not. That would be a shock to the economy we could not handle. But how do we start moving forward in slowing down our use of it and changing the parts of the economy? There are so many things that need doing in the world. I mean, planting our agriculture system, again, when we talk about how productive farmers have been, one of my colleagues says we should be measuring jobs per acre, not bushels per farmer, because vegetable farming, healthier types of food production is much more labor intensive. And finding a way to do that, we may not have, if you do an economy like that, you won't have the money to buy as many flat screen TVs or new cars or other things. They may last longer if you build them right and do it that way. But more of our dollars, when we say, well, what is it, less than 10% of the American budget, household budget goes to food, it's a fraction of what it was. In European countries, grocery costs are far higher percentage of your income, but they're healthier foods, everything else. As you make the changes to a more person-based economy, you can make the switch. The point is, right now, the only solution we have is what you said, consume more. That's the way we boost the economy. We have to make that shift. It's not going to happen overnight, and each step along the way, we're not going to know how we're going to ultimately get to where you get the sustainability, but you have to start moving that way. So I think the point is, don't feel, I had one colleague who said, well, you say you think you can get to 100% fossil fuel free. Oh, what are you going to do? Put windmills on top of cars. And then it was the car drives for the windmill. It doesn't work, obviously not. But they're trying to ridicule the idea of trying to make the change. And the point is, you're right. You couldn't do the change overnight. You have to do it, but we better move it more slowly and gradually. You and you.
So it seems like part of what's fueling our consumerism is our American attitudes about land use policy and property rights, and we're building bigger and bigger homes, so we have to buy more things to fill up our houses. I mean, I am encouraged that the millennials have this movement back to the city and empty nesters, more efficient land use, but I guess the question is, when the millennials decide to have children, where are they going to live? Are they going to then want to upsize
right.
the bigger houses?
I do think you got a notable point that there is a change in the millennial generation. In a certain point, we have to change. Chris Sharon has been doing some talks about, in terms of the Little House on the Prairie stuff, on how the Homestead Act gave people quarter section, 160 acres, just because they'd settle it for free. You don't get that anymore. On the boat up from Lake Chelan, I talked to the guy who's the third owner of a property on the other side of Lake Chelan. The boat drops him off there, and the third owner, since it was homesteaded 100 years ago, it was given to them in exchange for it. We're not giving away land anymore, and prices, people who have had cabins in the family for three generations in Minnesota, a lot of people with 10,000 lakes have a lot of cabins. They can't afford them anymore because they're being bought up by folks who have more money and tear down the little ones, and so the property tax value goes way up. They won't be able to do it that way, but I do think there is actually a mindset shift in the millennial generation where more and more are at least aware of we can't keep doing what we're doing. That doesn't change, and they will have more needs as they go, and maybe as we age, we feel we need more things too.
Well, I was just talking earlier with my husband that I would like to see more local state legislation limiting outsides, rather so that you're not seeing huge footprint. We do a lot of minimal.
Right.
We talk about small houses, but then at the same time, and that's not, I mean, that's something that can come with time, but the fact that someone can build a, you know, you look at the news, you know, Puget Sound Business Journal in the back, 30,000 square foot home for two people,
mm-hmm.
and all the resources
right.
going into that, while we in the Puget Sound, Seattle, all around, we have a huge homeless problem.
Right.
And that it's allowed, we're allowed to be building a home with such a huge footprint.
I think Portland actually has maximums for.
Portland does have a lot of land using. On that point, I wanted to say, first of all, this again gets back to the people of the faith community also, too. I mean, how much do we consume versus the people around us? I get a bigger house, more people are homeless. Not my problem.
Right.
Well, it is our problem. But to your point about limiting house size or land size, I tried about, because we were trying to do some things like Portland was doing to stop urban sprawl. In Twin Cities, I've lived there, I moved up there right after college. I've lived in Twin Cities almost 40 years. The land area of the Twin Cities is far more than doubled. I think it's probably fivefold, sixfold increase in that 40-year period of time. We do that again. There's no farmland. If you make it a four or fivefold increase in the next 40 years, and the four or fivefold in the next 40, after 80 years, there's no farmland left. You're swallowing up all the land. But I tried about 20 years ago to try and say some of our suburban communities were having minimum lot size of 10 acres because they wanted it, some of the wealthy suburbs, they wanted people to do it. 10 acres, you got a very remote place. We run all the pipelines out to their houses, all this. They had building codes that when I was trying to say, no, you could not have unlimited lot size things, and it was kind of like one of my colleagues who represented one of those communities said, you know, my constituents, they worked hard. This is their land. They own it. And my point is, I can guarantee you, that's your concept of ownership, but I can guarantee you not one of them, but 30, 20 years later, lots change, I bet you not one of them will be the owner of that land 100 years from now. They own it temporarily.
Right.
And as stewards of, is, I mean, our faith teaches us that it's a lot different. So.
Touched on something that's been rolling around in my mind, which is this idea of entitlement. Like, I've worked hard for it, so I got to give myself, which always feels to me so in contradiction to,
right,
to what our faith says, which is we're not entitled to anything, that everything that we have is a gift
it's
from
a
God,
gift.
And that we're given, and that we feel like, well, I've worked hard for this, so I deserve it. I earned this. I need it. And it wrapped kind of circular around for me into this idea of status. And I was thinking, Tom, about what you were saying about, well, what are we going to do then? How are we going to have jobs? We're going to have this collapse. And I feel like at some point, people have to start changing their idea of what is an acceptable job.
Mm-hmm.
Because at some point, honestly, with the rate we're going with garbage and all of that stuff, garbage technicians are going to have to be an acceptable job because they're going to need so many people sorting garbage and things like
pulling resources out of the garbage. You're right.
Yeah, and that's just one example, but like, you know, if we're going to look at trying to shift how we use our economy and things like that, we're going to have to start shifting our mindset of what is an okay job to have, or what makes you lower status, or how do we shift our mindset around that is an important job, you know,
mm-hmm.
that whatever it is, if it's sweeping streets, or, you know, being the recycle technician, or the person who does this or that, we have to start saying, you know, I mean, and I think that, you know, every parent wants to be proud of what their child does. Oh, they're going to law school, or, you know, I mean, not many of them would be like, I hope they grow up to be a garbage man. But we have to shift that and say, that's okay, if that's because that's an important job. And I think that we, maybe as parents of the older generation, bear some of the burden of saying, we recognize that what's coming behind us has to shift, and we have to be open to that and not make them feel like, oh, you're choosing
you're,
not to go to college,
you're, not
you're going to
right.
do something different. It has to be okay.
Right.
And we have to bear some of that burden and understanding that.
Very well said, and when your point about we feel we're entitled to it because we earned everything we did, the corollary to that is, of course, all those other people are lazy bums trying to leech off of me.
Yes.
We everything we got was ours, but
yeah.
those people, which is the way we divide in society.
Yeah.
I want to keep going quickly. We got. I can go till 10 after or whatever, but I think there were.
Oh, thanks. So there was a study a while back that asked people how much was enough, basically, and it was related to income, and almost universally the response was 15% more. Right. So if they made $100,000, $115,000 would be enough. If they made
and they'd be happy with it, right?
Right, right. If they made $1 million, you know, $1.15 million. Would be enough to satisfy them. And I think that's a really natural human inclination to just feel like you need to have a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to actively police ourselves and
right.
make sure that we resist that temptation in every decision that we make and understand our inclination to want
very important. And to train not just ourselves, because the goal is not just educating ourselves, but to change the whole community. So, oh, okay.
That was an assist.
Oh, okay. That's a couple of hands to get one. So over there.
I'm a alderman in a city just outside of Chicago, completely landlocked, 6 square miles, 56,000 people. So you're all talking about 10 acres? Our regular lot size is 1,300.
Right, right.
Square feet. I'm just struck by revolution. You put the numbers on how long it takes to add 1 million people.
Right.
If we continue to do it the way we're doing it, the world will revolve.
The world will revolve. Yeah.
And the things that we take for granted now, it's changing. It will change. It has to change. There's no way in the world I can continue to put a McMansion on a 1,300 square foot lot.
Well, they try.
God love them.
Nine floors.
And right, block out of the sun, because really you can't quantify that. So we talk about whether we're going to stay consumers. We're not going to have a choice. If we don't get in front of it, if we don't start making decisions that open up new opportunities, it will be taken from us, and the choices will be made, and we will be wringing our hands. And I'm deeply concerned. I've been in this job now for 2 whole months.
your point, I think, is very important. I think when we're talking educating, we got to do this, educate this, and kids teach their parents and do this, and we got to learn to change our mindset. I think what you just said helps keep in focus. This isn't optional to do this. We don't have time. We're running out the clock on climate. We're running out the clock on resources. And all the statistics and all the things we've been talking about, we can't continue to do what we're doing. So when people say, well, you're never going to persuade people to change that, when 20 years ago when I tried that thing to say you couldn't just have unlimited lot sizes, it was kind of, I got one vote. I wasn't on the committee. I got one vote on the committee, and I think it was somebody feeling sorry that I did not get beat 11 to 0 or whatever. But I think I can't believe that 30 or 40 years from now, that in much of the world, and including much of our country, that that's going to be, well, why were you, I mean, I think no matter how bold we think we're being in our actions, I've used this in talking about climate, no matter how bold we think we are as a politician, as somebody in our lifestyle or something, I think our grandkids are going to be saying, you saw the evidence of what was happening. Why didn't you act?
You did nothing.
And I think that's, you're helpful to frame what we're all talking about, because I think we recognize this, but it's in the back of our mind and we don't really want to believe it because it's frightening. Yes. Go ahead.
Regarding trash, I think, and I've been in India and I've seen mountains and mountains of those plastic bags all over, just like the picture you had there in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
And I think people really respond to money, both the consumer and the producer. Just simple things, like in Seattle, if they charge 5 cents every time you took out a plastic bag at the grocery stores, people aren't going to use plastic bags. Yeah. Isn't that what they charge or something?
Yeah.
So that's just in your community. Regarding the producer, if you make it lucrative enough, right now you can buy bulk items there. Fred Meyer, you may perhaps, if you made it lucrative enough for the producer, like dairy items, you go in with your, glass canister, container. If you made it lucrative enough for the producer, they're going to fill that need. And we make it so that it's attractive for them.
Minneapolis was banning plastic bags they actually passed an ordinance to do that. So the legislature put in another bill, a budget bill we didn't even get a vote on as a separate item, to ban cities from regulating plastic consumer bags. Because they're so certain we should not interfere with the economy. And when you're saying you may provide the price differential to cover that, the trouble we have, the reason you need that price differential is because the economy, our economic system, we don't pay all the costs when we buy it. If I produce fuel for your car, I'm not paying for the value of what I'm taking out of the earth. I'm paying a mineral rights fee, paying the cost of hauling it, transporting it, selling it in the economy, and the cost to people's health, the cost to the climate, the cost to anything else. Those external costs are never factored into the pricing, so nobody's paying the true cost. And what you're saying is we could change that by economics. And we really have to recognize the cost for electricity shouldn't be measured in the pennies per kilowatt hour it takes to generate and sell it. It should be talking in the, if you take the environmental costs, we would have zero coal, zero most of our fuels, because the environmental costs would blow it off the charts. You had both of you back there.
Just from a business viewpoint, I work for an environmental consulting firm in Seattle, and we cannot hire staff members right out of college unless we can show that we're doing something that's sustainable in our company. They don't want to work for a company that doesn't have a sustainability plan. So they go to the website, take a look at the company, and if we don't have a really good, genuine way that we're showing we're helping the environment,
they're not interested.
We don't get them. And so the other side.
That's education working, yes.
Right. On the other side, the municipalities, of course, people that are giving us contracts, we have to answer a question in the contract proposals and the interviews. Tell us about your firm's sustainability plan. And we won't get the contract if we don't have a genuine sustainability plan. So it's competition now.
Right. It's good to hear. I mean, it means the educational process is working, which one of you made the point about the millennial generation seeming to be different. I think that's happening, and it has to happen. I mean, it has to happen across the board. So you have another point? By the way, I think we'll go if it works for people till 10 after, but if you want to leave, feel free to do so.
Yeah, I have a question. You know, we have so many causes and actions that you can take, and you know, I strongly believe in analysis paralysis, you know, where when you have so much, you just don't act. Is there one or two or three things that, in your experience, you can say, here are the three things that you guys can do to impact these today?
Okay. Good point, and if I had the perfect answers for it, it would be great. But no, I think certainly, in terms of big picture, first thing you do is try every way you can. Try and live as if that bottle that I'm reusing because I'm at Holden Village, try and act in your own life. How can I reduce my consumption of products, especially wasteful things? Consumption of going to a theater or a concert or something else is not consuming resources. Consuming human talent is a better way to spend money, and that's something you can talk about if you have the money to do that. I mean, a lot of people are struggling to pay for things, but certainly your own life is the first thing you try and do, and educate your family and try and change things. When I stay at a hotel, I take the leftover bar of soap home. I don't open a new one. I don't open those little plastic bottles of shampoo. I'll bring my own, what little you can bring on an airplane and so on now, but I'll bring the bar of soap home and reuse them, wrap it in a piece of toilet paper or Kleenex if it's gooey. But that seems wasteful. I don't tell people that. I mean, I'm telling it at Holden in this conversation. But that sounds nuts. And I won't open those little bottles because there's more plastic for one shampoo goes there. So your own behavior is first. The second one, in addition to trying to educate others about the importance of that. Again, I'm going to hype that book, Affluenza. It may be in the book. I think it's in the bookstore, but you can get it at a bookstore. It talks about how we consume and how to do it. The second thing is public policy. Trying to persuade others. Trying to contact local elected officials, as people in Seattle did on the plastic bag thing, as people do with state legislatures and other places. At the federal level, getting through to somebody and having an impact is buried so much in the big money, but trying to change public policy and speaking out on it and blogging, putting posts on Facebook, sharing ideas, that's the second thing I do. So one is your own behavior, and two, trying to change attitudes and influence public policy. That's very short, quick way of doing it. Yes?
So this may sound like a small problem when we're talking about bigger things, but one of my frustrations is within our church. Mm-hmm. We have enough dishes to serve 200 people, and yet we don't use them. We buy paper plates, paper bowls, paper cups.
Right.
And I can't seem to get a change. them to change.
Right.
The education doesn't seem to work. And it's very frustrating. If anybody has had success at changing a mindset within a church.
In the church, because the churches are some of the places we ought to be doing the teaching on this very much. And I do think using some of the statistics or these beautiful quotes that you can go just for reading signs at Holden. And by the way, in speaking about Holden, I think at Holden we learned so many good practices, but we also have to understand the difference. And one of the things I want to suggest to, I'm going to leave in suggestions when I leave, is for Travis and others to be talking when we talk about sustainability. Recognize there are a couple of things that are different here at Holden that we should not copy, one of which is leaving on lights, which we shouldn't do here either, but it's free because the hydro is going, and we get it. It's not hitting something new. In an outer community saying, well, we're going to use it because we got some hydropower in Washington State, well, you know, the more that's used there, the more we have to use other sources for other things. So while they're very cautious about waste and things here, electric lighting would be one of them. Don't copy here because it's a very unique situation. And the second one I'll say in Janice is keeps our lawns, everything beautiful here. And it's the water is coming out of the thing. It's going right back into the river. And we have less dust, healthier community, and we have beautiful grasses and gardens and so on. Because of that, that's a gift we have because this is here. But if we do that back home, if we water lawns that way, if we do that, hey, we got to change. A lot better to have prairie grasses in Minnesota. We're converting our lawn to prairie grasses. Neighbors haven't complained yet. We're hoping they don't. It's much better. But again, those are things that most of the things we learn here at Holden are perfectly transferable to home. But in terms of like electric use and water use, we have to recognize that this is a very unique thing where it's not an environmental harm to do that.
Well, the other thing is this is only a summer thing, too. If you're here in the winter...
Oh, I know. Electric use, you don't leave any light on.
You don't use the water.
And so the summer, the guests here at home, we don't see what they go through at that time of year, but that's important to keep in mind. Claudia.
Yeah, I had wondered about the same thing, that we in our churches often don't do.
Thanks for
coming. What we should be doing. And I think, I mean, so much comes back to convenience. And I think we just have to come to a state where we're willing to be inconvenienced. And I've been guilty of that too, you know. I mean, it's just so much easier to take two big bags of trash out than standing in the kitchen together for an hour to take care of dishes, you know.
Right, right.
But, you know, if I'm not willing to do the dishes afterwards... then I can't expect of the others to do it. So I have to look at myself.
That's the whole concept behind fast food, too. I mean, it's easier for somebody else to do it, or convenience foods and so on. Yes?
Two things. One, I generally, when I'm staying at a hotel or something, and I will ask the people behind the desk, do you save your soap that's left over and give it to the homeless so they can use it? Well, hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah, there's a group that is organizing with hotels to collect that up, and this group was exporting it, I think, overseas. So, you know, so it's a small effort, maybe.
That's a really good one, because it's a really good point. What I'm doing is changing a little bit. I'm taking one bar of soap. I don't open up anything I don't need, and I take the leftovers, even though it seems weird. I always come home with all these things, and people, if I forget to take them out and somebody sees them, you're kind of, what's all these half-used soap bars for? But you're saying, teach the hotel. Teach the hotel and do that. And the hotels are hearing, because what you're saying about you can't employ people if you're not doing sustainable things. How many hotels, some of them will give you a benefit in some other way. You get free internet access instead of whatever, faster access, if you don't require us to change your sheets each night. I'm to the point now, every time I'm in a hotel room, I put a do not disturb on the door and leave it there all day. When I come back at night, there's often a note saying, we're unable to change your room. If you want, tell them at the desk and we'll do whatever. I do that because I don't want them to change sheets and towels and everything else. It's terribly wasteful, and some hotels give you the option now, but I think you have exactly the right point. Don't just change yourself. Don't do it for yourself. Tell the hotel you'd appreciate that. And the fancy hotels, a lot of them are getting it because they can market as we're a green hotel.
Second point, we have a connection in France. And not that the French do many things right, according to us. But a gallon of paint there, a gallon of house paint, is about $150. And you convert it from liters to and euros to dollars. Uh-huh. Half of that cost is environmental costs. Part of it goes to what's being produced, the environmental issues of producing it. The other half is what it's going to produce, the paint in the future. So
I'd love to hear more information on that if you have any. I'd love to see something, because that's the direction we do have to go. And it is interesting when we talk about renewable energy at the Capitol in St. Paul, Minnesota. That the solar, boy, with these subsidies, it's hugely expensive. We're not factoring in the, as I said, the hidden environmental costs of other things. But it's also, well, Germany and those places went all out in solar, and their energy transition that they're in the midst of is, I mean, they did more for bringing down the price of solar than anyone by making so much of that happen. And people, oh, you know how much they're paying per kilowatt hour? Whoa, off the charts in expense compared to us. German utility bills are probably maybe lower than ours. They consume a third as much because of efficiency, but what they're consuming is more expensive. But we say, look, if we had to pay that much per kilowatt hour, it put us all out of business. But so that's a good point, and I'd love to hear more if you have any resource I could contact about finding out how they deal with the pricing of something like that.
Because gas costs like three or four
right.
times as much as we're paying here, but it goes to various...
It goes to, and yeah. It, why have Europeans driven less? Why are their cities less sprawling? They don't need as many roads because people...
And the cars are smaller.
That's right.
And the plastic bags cost 25 cents a piece.
And they're far more willing to pay taxes than we are.
Yeah.
We are not willing to pay taxes.
I know.
We are not
willing. That's part of changing the discussion.
That's right. Yeah.
And
every
time
we have these conversations about right. gas prices, we could do that in a second.
Yeah. If we were willing to
Boom.
Do it. Right.
We go to $5 a gallon gas, and we solve many problems.
In 1999, our governor, professional wrestler, Jesse Ventura, proposed huge tax cuts because we had extra money. Republican House overwhelmingly passed these huge tax cuts. Even borrowing money increased the size of the rebate checks they gave out. The Senate was a Democratic Senate, and it passed 65-1. It was the only one who voted against it. My district was Republican-leaning. I survived it. You can survive those things. But we can't be grown-ups about talking about things like taxes. We assume the public won't listen to it. The public is not always well-educated, but the public isn't dumb either. And I think that's why the education is so important. And as you said, yeah, taxing things, raising prices, carbon tax. You could do a revenue-neutral carbon tax if people want. There's some people in Washington State working on it, some people in other states. You do a revenue-neutral carbon tax, so the money you spend more for electricity, the more you spend for transportation and so on, you get that back in other tax cuts. But it changes the economy, because as some things get more expensive, as you said, people use less. We got to quit in a minute, but you had one more, and I don't know if anybody else did. Yes?
I think what you're saying about inconvenience needs to carry over into a lot more places, because, yeah, it is an inconvenience to stay after and wash dishes, but also it's an inconvenience to spend a ton of money when they're, like, now, but there's going to be benefits in the future.
Right.
So in West Texas, there's tons of wind power. There's a ton of, wind turbines mm-hmm. out in West Texas. And I was talking with my boyfriend when we were driving. He's like, why aren't there more of these? He's like, they're too expensive, and people aren't willing to implement more now,
right.
pay the cost, even if it's going to benefit later.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing with taxes. It's an inconvenience right now. You're going to have to change the way that you budget and the way that you spend things. Like when gas goes up from a little under $2 to close to $3, it's an inconvenience mm-hmm. for you.
Right.
But that could easily solve more problems in the future. And I like the seven generations thing. Because I think a lot of people get so caught up in me and then maybe,
right.
like, your
they don't
kids,
think about it, right.
And you don't
yeah.
think about how it's going to come in the future.
Right.
I see it
and
as short-term
we,
versus long-term.
What?
I see it as short-term versus
right,
long-term.
Right, right. And this beautiful thing, the only place we've ever known to contain life, it's our home.
Mm-hmm, right.
And even dogs know not to mess up their own home. They go outside. I mean, we know not to trash our own home on an individual level, we don't understand it as a planet, and we better do that because there is no planet B. Thank you all very much. Enjoy the conversation.